Everyone has their coffee and their goodies and the dentist delight that we serve up on Wednesday here. We'll get started. Those of you who saw the flyer on Professor Belden might have been confused by the graphics, the little daggers at January 4th, 1984. Then there's a dagger, and then it says 10 a.m., and there's another dagger. Neither imply that January the 4th has died, nor 10 a.m. has died. Both of them are alive and well, and we're happy to be here. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Professor Belden Lane from St. Louis University. He is Associate Professor of Theological Studies, now in his seventh year of teaching there. He has the distinction of being the only Presbyterian on the faculty of St. Louis University, as far as we know, and teaches courses in American religion and church history. He has a PhD from Princeton, good old Princeton back in New Jersey, and basically came to his PhD there from some other background, from some fundamentalist background experience in Florida. He studied at the Moody Bible Institute and then went to Fuller Seminary, and now has been invited by us as the crowning glory of his career to deliver the Wenschel Lecture. Those of you who don't know anything about the Wenschel Lecture should be informed that it's named after a pastor of Christ Lutheran Church at 5101 16th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., if you're ever there. And attached to the church is a little chapel called the Wenschel Chapel. So it's a name, a venerable name that's been around in our circles for some time. So without further ado or histrionics, I present to you Professor Belden Lane speaking on reflections on narrative preaching or why we never fall asleep in the story.
Thank you, Dan. It's a delight to be here, especially greeted by Dean Templeman, a colleague and at St. Louis University as well as here. Let me begin with a story. A story first told by a Muslim Sufi mystic some 500 years ago. It was a teaching story used in spiritual direction. So imagine yourself sitting at the feet of the dervish master, hearing the tale as if it spoke to all the deepest longings and fears with which you begin this new year of 1984. Once upon a time, in a strange and distant land, high upon a great mountain, a gentle rain began to fall. At first, it was hushed and quiet, trickling down the granite slopes, and then gradually it increased in strength as the rivulets ran over the rocks and down the gnarled and twisted trees that grew there. And soon it was pouring as swift currents of dark water flowed together into the beginnings of a stream. The stream flowed on down the mountain, through valleys, past forests, down cascading falls, and soon it was far from its source in the distant mountains and found itself on the edge of a great and vast desert. Well, having crossed every other barrier in its way before this, it was convinced that it would be able to cross this as well. But as fast as the stream ran into the desert, that fast did its waters disappear in the sand. Finally, it heard a voice coming from the desert itself, whispering, "The wind crosses the desert. So can the stream." "Yes, but the wind can fly," shouted the stream, and it kept dashing itself into the desert. "You'll never get across that way," said the desert. "You have to let the wind carry you." "But how?" cried the stream. "You have to let the wind absorb you." Well, the stream couldn't accept that. After all, it had never been absorbed before. It didn't want to abandon its individuality, give up its own identity. And besides, if it ever gave itself to the arms of the wind, could it be sure once again of becoming a stream? Well, the desert said that it might keep on flowing into the desert, and that one day the stream might even make a swamp there at the edge of the desert, but it would never cross the desert while remaining a stream. "Why can't I remain the same stream that I am today?" cried out the stream. And the desert replied, "You never can remain what you are. Either you become a swamp, or you give yourself to the winds." Well, the stream thought for a long time and listened to certain echoes deep within itself, remembering parts of itself having been held in the arms of the wind before. And then, slowly and gently, it raised its vapors to the welcoming arms of the wind, and it was borne up easily, gently upwards, and over the desert in great white clouds to distant peaks on the other side, where it began to fall down the distant side of those mountains as gentle drops of rain. At first, it was hushed and quiet, trickling down the granite slopes. And then it increased in strength as rivulets ran over the rocks and down the gnarled and twisted trees that grew there. And soon it was pouring as great currents of dark water flowed together into the beginnings of a stream once more. Why is it that we never fall asleep in stories? We may snore our way through sermons. We may conk out at the very beginning of a lecture. We may even doze off in front of the TV set, but we never fall asleep in story. There's a magic, isn't it, that happens when the words "once upon a time" are spoken in a circle of people. You find that bodies bend forward, that chairs are shifted as people actually move into a circle. Pens are put down, facial muscles relax, and everyone listens, expecting to be carried into a wholly new world of the imagination and delightfully lost there. This magic of storytelling is popular everywhere today. In theology, we finally come to realize that it's no longer just a fad. 20 years ago, we were trying to demythologize biblical faith, reaching through the primitive, naive story to the truth that was hidden in and beyond it. But today we recognize that the story itself is the truth, with all of its mystery and wonder. You don't reach through the story to some deeper proposition back there somewhere. The very story, with all its open-endedness, is God's preferred way of disclosing himself. This is a powerful insight. People like Amos Wilder, John Dominic Croson, Bernard Kelbert have explored it in scripture studies recently. David Tracy and Sally McFaig in systematic theology. Paul Ricoeur, of course, in hermeneutics. Stanley Hauerwas in moral theology. Fred Craddock, Fred Buechner in preaching. All of them doing marvelous things with story. So what is it about stories that enable them so powerfully to communicate the gospel to us? What I'd like to do is suggest in this hour 5 characteristics of good teaching stories. 5 reasons why certain stories, some of them biblical, some of them not, are able to grip us at the deepest level of ourselves and to draw us and our people as we preach into a new and richer understanding of faith. The first characteristic of those stories that are able to teach and mold and move us to God is that they have a life of their own. Stories live. The stories of God are always borne along by their own life. I think one of the most important things in storytelling is to remember that the story exists apart from my and your control of it as a teller. It lives its own life apart from me. In fact, I find again and again, and don't we all, that one never tells good stories so much as we have a sense of them telling themselves through us. There are times when I feel myself told by the story, if you would, as if it interpreted me more than I ever was able to interpret it. Isn't that the mystery of the gospel itself? That what I first grasped as an idea, I suddenly discovered grasping the whole of what I am. Now, there's a strong Old Testament basis for this whole idea of the power of story. You take the Hebrew word dabar, for example, the word meaning word or story, even the connotation of event. And this carries a very dynamic idea with it. Story, as dabar, is something that lives and moves by its own power. It leaves the mouth and goes out into the air to accomplish the task on which it has been sent. You find that, for example, in Isaiah 55:11, where it says the word of Yahweh does not return to him void, but it accomplishes the task on which it has been sent. In the Old Testament and the New as well, there is great power attributed to blessings, curses, spells, the power of spoken words. Now, Father Walter Ong at St. Louis University here in our city has spent his whole academic life trying to emphasize the significance of this oral tradition that underlies our Christian faith. He points out the differences between an older oral culture, which was prevalent at the time of the biblical revelation, and a more recent visual written culture that we are more used to today, accustomed as we are to communicating primarily by what we see and read. Now, it's very interesting, the differences in consciousness as to how you primarily communicate, whether through the ear or through the eye. There is a richness and interiority to sound that you don't find in the written word. You see, sound moves from the interiority of me. It begins right down here in the most sacred parts of myself. It moves out of me through the air into the interiority of you, through your ears, your sinuses, the whole of your head cavity. In fact, some scientists are telling us that we hear through all the pores of our skin. So that there is an interiority, a very much of a personal character. It's warm, it's alive. That's the nature of sound. In contrast, vision can only focus on surfaces. It can be very impersonal, vision can. Try, for example, sometime next time you're on a bi-state bus, try looking at somebody, staring at them for any length of time without speaking first, and you'll find fairly quickly you might get your head chopped off or at least a very angry stare in return. Because vision is that which, without spoken communication, tends to abstract and objectify. It makes surfaces of people. It's threatening. It's not nearly as human as sound, as orality. Now, the importance of what Father Ong does with all of this is that much of the power of Christianity, as it was first communicated nearly 2,000 years ago, came from the fact that it was spread by word of mouth. It's an oral phenomenon. It was some time before it was reduced, put into written words. So there is an immediacy, a spontaneity to the spoken word that lets it live in a way that words on a page never can. That's why maybe if you happened to see him some 4 or 5 years ago, when Alec McGowan was here at the Loretto Hilton Theater, he was so impressive to so many people as they heard as if for the very first time the gospel itself, as he recited in 2 hours St. Mark's Gospel, simply reciting the Revised Standard Version. People heard the gospel as if they'd never heard it before. Storytelling involves an oral magic, a power, a sacramental mystery of the spoken word that can't entirely be controlled. It has its own life. J.R.R. Tolkien speaks of a great cauldron of tales, stewing and steaming through the ages, seeking out at various times their own hearers and tellers, bearing their own life. Wasn't that the experience of Ezekiel? You remember at the beginning of his call to ministry? As he is told to eat the scroll of judgment and warning that he was to deliver to his people. The written word was to become part of his own flesh and blood. All of the pain and joy of it living within him, using his life as its life. That leads to a second characteristic of good teaching stories. They help root us in flesh and blood experience. Storytelling is a very embodied, a very incarnated way of communicating the gospel. The physical presence of the storyteller, for example, is always inseparable from the story itself. I think of some of the great storytellers today, someone like Jackie Torrance, for example, a magnificent woman. The gestures, the movement, the whole presence that she brings to a story is just as much a dimension of the tale as the words she says. You see, there's a strong physical reality that story thrives on. I've been taught this best by my own children. I have an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old at home. And almost every night still, we take part in a story ritual that they have been very careful to maintain. I get in the middle of Katrina's bed, and Jonathan gets under one arm, and Katrina gets under the other arm, and then I try to hold a book. It's very difficult, much less trying to turn the pages. And yet they insist on hearing the story in precisely this way. And the point is, I finally figured out, the point is that somehow physical contact is very much a part of the way my children receive the story. The more their bodies are involved in touching and moving and responding to the story, the more they fully seem to hear it. You notice little children hearing the story. They get right up as close as they can. And isn't that what Jesus did? He not only told stories, but he did it in a context of continually healing people by touch. Touching and telling. A marvelous combination for catechesis, for teaching in the church. And yet, sadly, we've hardly even begun to explore the importance of our bodies as a means of contact with the Holy. Our bodies as temples of the Holy Spirit. H. Wheeler Robinson tells us that there are some 80 parts of the body that are named in the Old Testament. 80 parts. Not once, incidentally, is the brain mentioned. The seat of consciousness doesn't lie in the head, but in the heart, in the liver, the kidney, the central part of ourselves, where sound originates. I'm convinced there are all kinds of things for us to learn here. Someday, a theology class will be taught with very few words, at least in terms of rational discursive discourse, mostly with stories. Someday, in theology classes, the truth will be communicated by mime and gesture, by sign language, by touching, by tears, by the movement of dance, the breaking of bread. That is the way Jesus will teach in the kingdom. And there is no reason why we can't begin teaching in that way now. This is so important because it lies at the incarnational heart of our faith. As Christians, we have to be rooted in flesh and blood experience. That is the meaning of our creed, the mystery of God become fully human. And yet, isn't it the case that the tendency in our theology is to become so highly cerebral and bloodless and spiritual in an abstract Neoplatonic way that we cut ourselves entirely away from the experience of our own bodies? Sally McVeigh asks, why is it that theologians so often step out of their skins when they think? It's no accident that the first Christian heresy was that of Docetism, you remember. the denial that Jesus had a real physical body. And so that's why the writer of 1 John has to stress that which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon and touched with our hands concerning the word of life, that we proclaim to you. It's the central earth story, the primary story of the death and resurrection of Christ, with all its earthiness and physicality, that forms the heart of Christian faith. And metaphor expresses that so powerfully. Metaphor is that which takes something familiar, ordinary, earthy, and concrete, rooted in our physical experience, and uses it to picture in a surprising way what is unfamiliar to us. Let me give an example in story. Once upon a time, there was a poor Jew who lived in a village in Eastern Europe, weary of his life, longing for a place where he could escape all of the struggle and all of the problems of this world. And so one day, finally, he set out in search of a mystical, magical city, the heavenly city, the city of his dreams, where he would no longer have struggles with this life. And he walked all day, and by evening of that day, found himself in a forest, decided to sleep under a tree, ate the crust of bread that he brought along with him, said his prayers, giving thanks to the master of the universe, and then, before going to sleep, took off his shoes and pointed them with the toes pointing in the direction that he would carry on the next day in further search of the magical city. He went to sleep and never really imagined that while he slept, a practical joker would come along and turn his shoes back around with the toes pointing back in the direction from which he'd come. But he woke up the next morning with all the folly of innocence. He said his prayers once more, put on his shoes, and started walking, as he thought, on in the direction of the magical city. He walked all day long, and about dusk of the second day, he finally saw it there in the distance, the magical city of his dreams, where everything would be wonderful. It wasn't quite as big as he expected that it might have been. And as he got closer, it looked curiously like his own hometown. But he pressed on, walked along a street that looked just like his own, came up to a house with a broken latch on it, just like the latch at his own house, knocked on the door, greeted the family that lived there, and stayed the rest of his life in the magical city of his dreams. The story expresses the reality so well. We can't escape to a heavenly city. God's meaning for our lives is to be discovered right here in the flesh and blood experience that we know. And that is where stories would take us. A third characteristic of revelatory tales, tales that lead us to God, is that they awaken right brain imagination. And it grows out of this very concern with the body. We've all read about left and right brain interests over the last several years. If some neurophysiologists are correct in their research into the two hemispheres of the brain, then it would seem that we all possess two different modes of perception. The left side of the brain is the more dominant one in our culture, and it is concerned with logic, with analytical reasoning, the ability to put ideas into words, and to solve math problems. Using this kind of linear cause and effect thinking, we construct our whole world, and we can know, most of the time, what to expect. But we use the right side of our brain, often, to deal with those things that don't fit into what is always rationally expected. Because the right side of the brain is concerned with chaotic imagination, with creativity, musical rhythm, nonverbal insight. These are great mysteries about how we are created in mind and body. Now, what is fascinating to me about the way Jesus told stories is that often he used them intentionally to confound left brain ordinary reasoning so as to appeal to right brain imagination. Now, you remember, Jesus was working with very religious people in first century Judaism. People who thought they knew exactly what the truth was. Sometimes those are the hardest people to preach to. They know what you ought to say. And so provocative parables were Jesus' favorite way of shocking them into realizing that maybe they didn't know the truth after all. Now, this is a very peculiar preaching device. But Jesus often told stories so as to make strange the truth, to confuse his listeners. Now, isn't that odd? And thereby engage them more deeply in a truth that was new and shocking. Now, it sounds crazy. We all are taught in all of the homiletics classes that we've ever had that good communication involves making things every bit as clear as possible. And yet, when you think about it, how often are we provoked into thought sometimes by what doesn't fit our expectations? Can you think with me about the possibility of comparing Jesus, in some of his parables, to a Zen master who uses a koan to break up the dependence of his listeners on their ordinary ways of thinking? Like the classic koan in Zen Buddhism, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Ridiculous. What is the sound of one hand clapping? Doesn't make any sense. And it doesn't make any sense either to be told that people who work all day in the field be paid the same amount as those who work for only 1 hour. And it doesn't make any sense either that the prodigal son is welcomed back with more joy than the faithful son who had never left to begin with. Isn't it the case that often with the parables of Jesus, our tendency is to say, I don't know just what it means, but I'm sure I don't like it. Take, for example, the parable of the Good Samaritan. That very phrase, Good Samaritan, would be a contradiction in terms in first century Judaism. No one who was an Orthodox Jew, of course, could think anything good about Samaritans. They claimed to be descendants of the old 10 tribes of northern Israel, and yet they terribly misinterpreted the law. They even rejected the temple in Jerusalem, setting up their own temple at Mount Gerizim. Jews would cross the Jordan River 2 times on their way between Judea in the south and Galilee in the north so as not to step on that God-forsaken land of the Samaritans. Even according to rabbinical teaching in the first century, it said that accepting alms from a Samaritan would mean delaying the coming of Messiah. It's in that context that Jesus tells the story. Now, John Dominic Crossan says it's very hard for us to grasp the shocking quality of many of the parables of Jesus today. Maybe we need to rethink that parable. Say, for example, that there is a Jewish soldier on his way back from Beirut coming along some country road, and he steps inadvertently on a landmine which blows off his foot, and he's trying to apply a tourniquet to save his life, lying down on the side of the road, when along comes a jeep. It is driven by a staff member from Prime Minister Shamir's cabinet who sees this terrible sight and wants to help, but he's afraid that it might be some kind of booby trap. So he hurries on, of course, planning to radio back help as quickly as he can. Next along that road comes, say, a car with American Jewish tourists who've rented a car in Tel Aviv. They've gotten hopelessly lost. And they're coming along this highway, and they see this ghastly sight. And they want to help, too, but they don't have first aid training, and they don't know what to do. So they hurry on, and they plan to call a hospital and get help back there as quickly as they can, too. And then finally, who is it that comes by but a Palestinian soldier, a member of the PLO, who stops and binds the man's tourniquet, binds his wounds, takes him to a hospital and promises that he'll try to sneak in another day or two to see how he's doing. And suddenly, if Jesus were to tell that tale in Jerusalem today, smashing into the minds of the listeners would come this utter impossibility of the idea of a good terrorist. And he'd be driven out of town pretty quickly. Ernst Fuchs, a New Testament scholar at Marburg, says that Jesus creates here what he calls a language event. In a language event, something new is brought into being that wasn't there before the words were spoken. Language is a marvelous thing. We think that it simply is used to describe objects. But language also creates. In a language event, there's a new possibility, a new alien world being created into which the listeners are invited to participate. They're led through the story to say things in their mind that they can't conceive of themselves doing or saying in reality. But because they've said it, because the story has ground those new grooves into the cerebrum, there is now open the possibility for doing it. That the power of language is guided by the Holy Spirit. It's what God longs to do through our preaching on a regular basis. It's supposed to only be 3 points in the sermon. I've got 5 points here. Let me go on to the fourth. A fourth characteristic of tales that can generate faith. And that is that they offer a truth deeper than true. I mean by that they convey more than just accurate information. Now, a very basic question that people often ask about stories is whether they're true or not. You know, storytelling has kind of a pejorative connotation to it. Isn't it the fact that still we tell our children not to tell stories when what we really are meaning is that we don't want them to lie? Did that really happen? We often ask when someone tells a story. Did the Red Sea divide exactly in the way Cecil B. DeMille depicted it in the Ten Commandments? That's a question you may well get in the parish. Another example, my daughter Katrina will sometimes ask after we've read a fairy tale together, is that true, Daddy? Did Cinderella's rags really turn into a beautiful gown? And often I don't know exactly what to say to that question because I'm not sure exactly what it is she's asking for. And I don't want to say, oh, that's just a story, Katrina. Of course, in real life, rags don't change into dresses. The chemical composition is such that it can't be altered in that way, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to say that because she may not be thinking on the level of precise and accurate information. In the Exodus story, for example, Moses wasn't primarily interested in scientific authenticity. Can you imagine Moses responding to a television interviewer after the Red Sea crossing as if he were caught up in precise and accurate reporting? Well, yes, Howard, the wall of water on either side did lay at precisely a 90-degree angle to the dry ocean floor. It stood at a height of 18 feet 9 inches on the upstream side, and you could barely perceive a 2.5-inch drop on the downstream side, indicating that indeed the sea had been stopped in mid-flow. And I noticed also that day a greater density in the water itself as I made periodic core samples in the side as we walked across. The hope, of course, being in all of this, that this data may help us to reproduce the event under controlled laboratory conditions at another time. My daughter Katrina, in asking about Cinderella's gown, may have no more interest in that kind of answer than the Jews who were miraculously delivered out of the bondage of Egypt that day. In fact, a Jewish midrash can embellish on the story, saying that when the Red Sea divided, it wasn't just one division, but it divided into 12 different cuts, one for each of the 12 tribes of Israel, and that the water between each of the cuts rose to a height of 600 miles. It was frozen there, turned from salt into sweet water, and was perfectly crystal clear as the children of Israel walked through, waving to each other through the water as they passed on the other side. That is God's deliverance. Katrina may be no more interested in scientific accuracy than were the Jews that day. Instead, Katrina may be asking. She may be asking about the likelihood of the Cinderella within her someday becoming beautiful. When she says, "Is that story true, Daddy?" Wondering if maybe it's possible that she might become more than the fearful, insecure, ugly-feeling child she sometimes feels herself to be. And if that's what she's asking, then I want to tell her that it sure can happen. At times, I've even seen the miracle of my own rags turned into beauty. So when we talk about the truth of stories, we have to be sensitive to two levels here. The level of accurate stored information and the level of life-changing reality. And the answer you give depends on what level the question was asked. And revelatory tales are usually most concerned with this second level of life-changing truth. Isn't it the case that in American Sign Language, the sign for story is this pulling, is that right? A pulling kind of motion. Storytellers often are pejoratively called stretchers of the truth. And yet, when you think about it, isn't that a beautiful characteristic of truth? To think that it's stretchable. That it's not a brittle, rigid surface thing, but something that can be pulled and wrapped around us, twisting us into new things. I tell you, truth isn't simply data. It's an encounter. Daddy, is the story true? Did the Velveteen Rabbit actually become real after the boy had loved him for so long? Of course he didn't. And of course he did. Can you grasp the two levels at once? A last characteristic of teaching stories is that they possess a redemptive healing quality. Bruno Bettelheim expresses this so well in his book, The Uses of Enchantment. He argues especially for the value of fairy tales in helping people to achieve personality integration. And one of his favorite illustrations of this integrative process that all of us hopefully go through as we mature as adults, as persons, is the frame story from the 1001 Nights. If you remember that tale as a child, King Shahryar has been deceived by his wife. She was unfaithful to him, messing around with one of his slaves while he was away. And as he returns in a fit of perfect anger, he determines that never again will a woman betray him. And to make sure, he has the wife put to death, and he marries a new wife every day and has her put to death the very next morning. I guess a pretty effective method for preventing adultery in that situation. But after a dwindling supply of young women in the kingdom, the clever and beautiful Scheherazade determines to stop the cycle and become a means of deliverance. And that night, after they're married, and as the king has trouble falling asleep, and I would think he would have trouble falling asleep, she tells stories. And she is a consummate storyteller, able to carry him into worlds of the imagination he'd never known before. And also, very conveniently, she's not able to finish this magnificent story that she has begun when dawn comes and it's time for her to be put to death. And she says, "Golly, it's too bad. I'm supposed to be put to death now." And the king says, "Well, maybe we can wait till tomorrow night so that you can finish the story then." And, of course, it goes on for 1001 nights, as each time she's not able to complete the story by the next morning. In the process, think about it now. You've got nearly 3 years of story therapy going on here. In the process, not only does she save her own life and the life of others, but both she and the king are changed. The stories have a way of therapeutically helping him to work through his disgust with life and his hatred of women. And she, in turn, falls in love with the king, finding in him an unrealized part of herself. This idea of the healing qualities of story is very intriguing. People in ancient India, back in the Vedic period, when coming to the priests or holy men with physical or emotional problems, would often be prescribed a story. Can you imagine a prescription slip given to you by a physician telling you to take stories before and after every meal? It might not be a bad idea. How much hypnosis and hypnotherapy is involved in storytelling anyway? I've often found with a very good storyteller working in a small group of people that you find everyone in the circle beginning to breathe with the teller. It's a marvelous thing. Shouldn't the church itself be that kind of conspiring community in which we breathe together and are healed by the stories of the gospel? Take Norman Cousins, who, of course, had some dread disease a few years ago, was told that he was terminally ill, checked himself out of the hospital, went to a hotel room where he saw old Marx Brothers movies and reruns of Candid Camera, and laughed himself back to health. We haven't begun to explore the full possibilities of healing that God might want to bring to us through story. Let me conclude this with one of the tales of the Baal Shem Tov. Rabbi Israel, the master of the good name, was a great rabbi in the 18th century, the founder of modern Hasidism. He was known for his mystical powers and his great stories. Martin Buber has many of them in his Tales of the Hasidim. And he tells one story of one of the Baal Shem's disciples who once spoke of how the master had told stories. This man who had been the master's disciple was now old and lame, no longer able to walk anymore. And he was speaking to his grandchildren, sitting in his chair, and explaining to them how the master could tell a story in such a way that it brought help and healing itself. And as the old disciple got excited, remembering how the master had told stories, he told how he used to hop and dance while he prayed. And the old grandfather rose to his feet unconsciously as he thought about it and was so caught up in his story that he too began to hop and to dance to show how the master had prayed and told tales. And from that hour, he was cured of his lameness. And I tell you, says Buber, that is the way to tell a story.
Healing and wholeness that ought to be a part of all of our communication of the gospel. Let me close with an example of what I'm talking about. I want to share with you a very sacred story. It's a Native American tale. Normally, I would be very hesitant to tell a Native American sacred story. Often, you have to be given the right to tell such a tale. But this one's been published. It's in Hemilo Storm, his book, Seven Arrows. I highly recommend it to you. It's a story that means a great deal to me. Once there was a mouse, a busy mouse with all kinds of busy mouse things to do, scurrying for berries and seeds, hurrying along little mouse trails. And yet, every once in a while, in the back of his hearing, he heard a roaring in his ears. Didn't know what it was. He asked some of the other mice one time if they heard the roaring. They said, "What are you talking about? There isn't any noise. We're too busy anyhow." And yet, he couldn't drown out of his hearing that sound of the roaring. And so one day, he made his way, walking away from where the mice lived, in the direction of that sound, hearing it gradually being a little louder, when suddenly a voice said, "Hello, little brother," and nearly shocked the little mouse out of his skin. It was a raccoon. And the raccoon asked him why he was so far away from the other mice. And he explained that he had heard this roaring in his ears and he wanted to find out what it was. "Ah," said the raccoon, "what you hear is the river." "River?" asked the mouse. He'd never heard of such a thing. "Come, I'll show you," said the raccoon. And so he went with him, hoping that maybe he would be able to persuade the raccoon to come back with him to tell the other mice that indeed there was something called river that was making the roaring. Finally, they came to the edge of it, and it was huge and breathtaking. Great and little pieces of the world carried along on its surface, floating. And the mouse said, it's magnificent, fumbling for words. "It is a great thing," said the raccoon. "But here, let me introduce you to a friend." And he pointed to a frog who was sitting on a lily pad right there at the edge of the river. And the mouse, he stepped up very carefully to the edge and he looked out and he saw reflected there in the water a very frightened mouse looking at him, and he said, "Aren't you afraid of being out there in the water?" "No," said the frog, thinking that he was talking to him. "I have been given the gift of living both under and above the river. When winter comes and this medicine is frozen, you can't see me. You can only come to visit me at this time of the year when the world is green." "Amazing," said the mouse, still fumbling for words. "Would you like some medicine power?" asked the frog. "Yes," said the mouse, and the frog told him to crouch down as low as he could and then jump up as high as he could. And so he crouched down as low as he could, jumped up as high as he could, and at the top of his jump, he saw the sacred mountains in the distance. Magnificent they were. He'd never seen or imagined anything like it. But then, as he fell back down, he landed in the river, and he was terrified and wet, scrambling back up onto the bank and saying, "You tricked me," to the frog. And the frog said, "You aren't hurt. Don't let your fear and anger blind you. What did you see?" "At the top of my jump," he said, I saw the sacred mountain." "Ah," said the frog, "then you have a new name. Your name is Jumping Mouse." The Jumping Mouse was very pleased with his new name, and he decided to go back home to tell all of his mice friends about what he had seen. And yet he was very disappointed, because when he returned, they would have nothing to do with him. Not only would they not listen, but they were afraid of him because he was wet, soaking wet, and it had not rained at all. There was no way that you could explain a mouse being completely wet unless, as one of the mice suggested, a larger animal had swallowed him up and then spat him back out because he was poisonous. And so they would have nothing to do with him. And yet, all the time burning in his heart was that memory of the vision of the sacred mountain. And finally, he determined to set off across the prairie in search of them. He was wary, of course, of all the spots in the sky, because each one of those circling spots was an eagle looking for just such a mouse as himself. And he scurried across the bare prairie, finally making his way to a patch of sage. It was a magnificent place. The sage smelled so good. There were little mice trails to explore. There were seeds. There were plenty of things there. He was tempted to stay. And he also found there an old mouse, very wise, who told him that from there you were safe from the eagles, that you could see the coyote, the buffalo, the rabbit, all the animals. You could see them and know their names. And you also know then of the river and the mountains, said Jumping Mouse. Well, yes and no, said the older mouse. The river I know of, but the mountains don't exist. There's no such thing. It's much too dangerous ever to try to hurry across the prairie in search of them. Jumping Mouse, with all the deliberation, determination that he could muster, determined the next day that he would still set out, nevertheless, in search of the sacred mountains. And he started running. As he ran across the bare prairie, he felt the shadow of an eagle on his back. And at the last moment, he scurried into a stand of choke cherries. Again, a wonderful place. Many cherries, many paths to explore. He was tempted to stay. And yet he heard heavy breathing. And he looked over to the edge of the bush of choke cherries and saw a great mound of hair and huge horns. It was a great buffalo. And he stepped out to see it. Thank you, little brother, for visiting me, said the buffalo. And Jumping Mouse said, why are you lying there? I'm dying, said the buffalo. My medicine has told me that only the eye of a little mouse will heal me, but there's no such thing as a mouse. One of my eyes, thought Jumping Mouse, he is too great a being to die. I can't let that happen. And so he spoke and said, I am a mouse, and I have two eyes, and here I will give you one of them. And in that moment, Jumping Mouse lost his eye, but the buffalo stood to his feet, restored to all of his strength. And he was so thankful, he told Jumping Mouse that he would help him make his way to the distant sacred mountains, letting him run along on the ground under his belly so that the spots wouldn't be able to see him. Well, Jumping Mouse was very frightened, running with only one eye and running under the belly of the buffalo with all these hoofs hitting ground around him. But he made it finally to the very beginnings of the sacred mountains. And he thanked the buffalo and told him, though, how frightened he had been. And the buffalo said, your fear was for nothing. You see, my way of running is the Sundance way. And I always know exactly where my hoofs hit. Jumping Mouse left the buffalo and started making his way up into the sacred mountain. Soon he came to a clearing, and he saw in the middle of the clearing a great gray wolf sitting there doing absolutely nothing, staring into space. He spoke to him, hello, brother wolf. And the wolf was awakened out of his trance and said, wolf, wolf, yes, that's what I am, and then lapsed back into his staring and sitting in complete motionlessness. Such a great animal, said Jumping Mouse, and yet the tragedy that he no longer knows who he is. He has lost his memory. And Jumping Mouse listened to the beating of his own heart. And finally he spoke again and said, brother, I know what will heal you. One of my eyes will make you well. And here, I give it to you. And in that moment, the mouse lost his second eye. But the wolf was raised to his full memory of himself. He knew what he was, and with tears streaming down his cheeks, he was so thankful, but his little brother couldn't see because he now was blind. The wolf explained that it was his task to guide creatures into the sacred mountains, and that even though Jumping Mouse now was blind, he, the wolf, would take him up into the high mountains and would speak to him of all that he saw. And so he carried him through the pines, he led him through the pines, up to the edge of a great high mountain lake. And he told him of all the beauties that they saw, and even the words burned within his heart as Jumping Mouse imagined himself there in the sacred mountain. The wolf left him by the edge of the lake, saying that he had other creatures to lead up into the mountain. And Jumping Mouse said goodbye, and he sat there knowing that there was no reason to run. He was blind. It would be just a few moments before one of the spots saw him. And so he sat there by the edge of the lake, and then he felt the shadow of an eagle on his back, and he heard the sound that eagles make, and he braced himself for the shock, and the eagle hit, and Jumping Mouse went to sleep. And then he woke up. And the joy of being alive was great. And he could see. Everything was blurry at first, but he could see. And a blurry shape came up to him and said, "Little brother, do you want some medicine?" And he said, "Yes, yes." "Then crouch down as low as you can and jump up as high as you can." And he crouched down as low as he could and jumped up as high as he could. And as he jumped, the wind carried him up higher. And the voice cried out, "Hang on, little brother, and trust the wind." And he closed his eyes and was carried higher by the air. And then he opened his eyes, and he saw the sacred mountains more beautiful than he'd ever seen. And the higher he went, the clearer they became. And then he saw down below his friend the frog by the river. And the frog called up to him and said, "Little brother, little brother, you have a new name. You are Eagle." "And they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint."
We have a few minutes for some questions, which we can entertain if any of you have any questions. Please.
I have, I guess, two questions that are probably interrelated. Do you think that there is a danger of setting up a false antithesis between storytelling and discursive? And if I understood you correctly, did you say that storytelling was God's preferred method? Then I would wonder what you make of, let us say, Roman, which is surely discursive as compared to Acts. I guess I'd be interested in knowing your reaction to Luther's evaluation of John.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't want to set up an antithesis between discursive reasoning and story. I think both are given to us by God as ways of exploring the fullness of who we are and our truth and our understanding of Christ. I guess I find myself very much influenced by Paul Ricoeur's understanding of what he calls the hermeneutical circle. how that in terms of a person's understanding of truth, that you often find yourself beginning at a very naive level of primitive story, of simply the experience, and then you find yourself having to reflect on that as you're led through what he calls a hermeneutics of suspicion, to ask all the most difficult questions, to do all the discursive questioning that you, that the truth requires. And then as you move through that, from the simple experience and the deep reflection on it, hopefully you move toward what he calls a second naivete, an ability to recover the truth once more in all the simple vitality that you first encountered it with, and yet also no longer in quite the same way, because you have applied criticism, you've done all the discursive reflection that is demanded, and so you have really become fully mature in your faith. I guess that in many ways is my experience as I move out of my very fundamentalist background, and yet a church that I grew up in the South, where I learned a great deal about the importance of Scripture and a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And all of that has stayed with me, very important. And yet through my experience of the last 25 years or so, there's been a need to question, reflect on that in terms of the Scriptures, in terms of the whole of the theological enterprise. And I find myself through story now coming back to a second naivete, if it were, to understand that original simple experience through all the reflective exercise of theological reflection. So I really don't want to separate those two at all. They're dreadfully important to be kept together. In terms of the Gospels, isn't John simply going on to reflect in with deeper spiritual insight on the original story? And Romans, I think, is Paul's effort to make sense of that story as well. So the primary way that God reveals himself to us is flesh and blood, through Jesus Christ, and the story that is told of that experience of his death, resurrection. And all that's written later is a reflection on that story.
Is there a second question? Sir?
Well, that's a good question. There are lots of good books you can read. In using story, one thing that I'd caution about here, I think, is that you have to avoid using stories as gimmicks. Stories simply as illustrations to kind of jazz up what, in your thinking, is better said in a proposition. I think sometimes in our learning to preach with story, it can be very important for us to learn, if you will, now this can sound crazy again, to learn to communicate not as completely as we're used to doing. You see, most of the time we're taught to be expert communicators. You want to get what is inside your head into the heads of your people as perfectly clear as possible. And often you get in the way of the Holy Spirit in doing that. Because sometimes if you are able to leave gaps for the imagination, if you resist the temptation to say everything, and you use a story for itself. Now, I could even see, now this may sound shocking, but I could even see a service in which I would tell one of the two major stories with which I either began or ended today, reading from 1 Corinthians 15, in reflection on the resurrection, the transformation that is at the heart of our faith, and using that story as the sermon. I submit to you it's got law and gospel in it. It's complete in itself without having to say, well, now for you dummies who missed the point of the sermon, or the point of the story, Let me tell you, in 3 points, 1, 2, 3, discursively, this is what the truth was. I think we need to depend upon the integrity of the tale. This is what Jesus did. He told in parables, and without parables, he refused to speak to the people very often. So I think, you need to find stories everywhere you can, out of your own experience, out of books you read, out of literature, the scriptures, of course. But you need to use the stories not as kind of an illustration thrown in, but to trust the story sometimes, to bear truth itself. I don't know if that helps some.
Further answer to your question, yes, you have to take courses. Sir.
I think in many ways that people, it depends on the kind of church that you serve, but many times in a church setting there is the sense in which people come fully knowing what the truth is. And my experience has been the need again and again to be shocked into realizing fuller, newer dimensions of that truth. So I would say in some ways there's a similarity there between the first century Judaism context and our own. That people, when they come to church, you know, let's face it, people know pretty much what to expect when they come to church. It's the same old thing. That's what we kind of expect when we come to church. And it's very easy at times for people who have been coming to church for years and years to assume that they know the gospel fully and to not realize the need to be awakened to it in new ways that story and parable might do. Usually only with You're right that Jesus did explain the parable sometimes, but it's usually with chagrin. It's usually, oh, gee, you guys, I wish you could get the point without my having to explain it to you. But then he would go on. So you're right. You've got a good point. That story needs discursive reflection along with it, surely. And I'm not saying, I don't want to extol right brain imagination and that simply every Sunday in the pulpit you simply tell stories at all. But I do want to suggest that there is need at times for leaving room for the Holy Spirit to work in the imagination. That sometimes, now this is hard for us to take, you know, we as communicators, as preachers, think that we have the truth and that we have to deliver it. Sometimes the Holy Spirit may celebrate the possibility for our people getting off the point of what we're making and in their imagination being taken to something new. And can I kind of speak with that kind of openness to the Spirit's leading? That's a question I think that needs to be asked.
Any other questions? Sir?
Thank you.
Let me help you there, maybe. I spoke of two levels of truth, truth as accurate information and truth as encounter. I would never want to separate the two. That would be incredibly dangerous to do that. But I also recognize that it's never enough for me to have an intellectual comprehension of the truth as written on a page, even in the pages of Scripture. It's never enough to own that truth as absolute and separate out there beyond me. It's absolutely necessary for me to be changed by that truth, for it to mold and move me. And story, I think, is a way of truth embracing, grabbing us at deepest levels of ourselves to be changed by it. I think that some of the dangers, I look back on my seminary experience, some of the dangers of seminary, the necessary dangers, is that you are caught up in all the very careful work, the study, the discursive analysis of scriptural texts and so forth, and very seldom, except maybe through chapels and liturgy, is there the possibility for us to really realize that all of this which we stand over and study is something that sneaks up behind us and grabs and changes us. And that's the power of truth. So I wouldn't want to separate the two, but I guess I am tending to emphasize the power of truth as you encounter it, as it encounters you, as you're changed by Jesus Christ.
Okay, I think we have time for about two more questions. Mrs. Friendly?
Thank you. Thank you. Very good. I think so, yeah.
Okay, final question here, please.
Hemios Storm. S-T-O-R-M. He was given that story as a sacred revelation from his Native American background. And I guess he would say, I think if I could speak for him, that his purpose is that he had no choice but to, because it was a great mystery that had been disclosed to him. I don't want to talk about that story in terms of explaining. I could talk about transformation, resurrection, and so forth, and speak of the real meaning behind the story. But I guess my main concern here this morning is for us to think about the story as bearing the truth itself. And that's, I think, what would be his main concern with the tale. Thank you.
Thank you again very much.